Welcome to the latest episode of Out of Left Field Podcast. We are podcasting from the Gulag Archipelago of Soviet Kanuckistan, otherwise known as beautiful Vancouver Island. With us today, can we get a quick roll call, please? I'm Ben, your producer and co-host. We also have Anthony.
Ahoy, hoy.
Ethan.
Hello there.
Our senior Zoomer correspondent, and Mackenzie.
Hi.
We are going to be talking about renewable energy and something other than the fucking coronavirus that everyone is so sick of hearing about constantly.
Hell yeah.
Don't worry, it'll come up. It always comes up. It'll be mentioned, as always, forever. We'll be talking about the coronavirus for the next 20 years.
It's in the margins.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is foreshadowing.
Yeah, true story. So if you want to support the show, if you're lucky enough to still have a job with this coronavirus pandemic, then consider going to patreon.com/outofleftfieldpodcast or just give us a good review on iTunes or a like and subscribe, etc. And we're also part of a broader podcast network of left-wing political commentary and news that you can find at www.ricochet.media.
The Ricochet Media Podcast Network features such wonderful podcasts as The Alberta Advantage, Kino Lefter, and 49th Parahel. Check them out. We podcasters have been hit a little bit hard by the COVID-19 pandemic, and we know that you have been too, but we are looking forward to continuing to bring you the most hard-hitting COVID and non-COVID related political content from this side of the globe.
And don't forget Andre Goulet's Unpacking the News. And I think there's a couple others now, too, but it's hard to keep track.
There's a whole bunch. It's awesome. We're growing. Hey, we're one of the most progressive sectors of the economy.
Yeah, well, you know,
one of the only sectors of the economy.
We are the 1850s coffee shops.
All right. Welcome to the show, Matthew Klippenstein. A clean tech engineer and contributor to the National Observer. And we're going to spend today talking about something other than the coronavirus, which I'm sure everyone is sick to death of hearing about. And we're going to be talking about clean tech, renewable energy, and the transition away from fossil fuels. Matthew, how are you doing and how is your pandemic coming along?
Thanks for having me, guys. Thoughts for Ali, who couldn't join us tonight. But the pandemic has been less affecting of my white collar typical class of folks. And I was very disappointed that, for example, Amazon and Walmart employees weren't able to have their general strike, because there's a very asymmetric impact of the virus on the different sectors of the economy. In broad terms, if you're fortunate by fluke to have a job where you can remote in and do knowledge sector stuff which you are actually paid for, then it is less catastrophically bad than it is for many of our fellow cousins across Canada and the world.
True story. So we're going to be spending the hour talking about clean tech and whatnot and clean energy. So just to give our listeners something of an idea, what is your background in renewable energy and what are the kinds of projects and stuff you've been researching in the field?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Sorry for that long-winded earlier comment there.
No problem.
I'll be more concise.
This is a podcast after all. You can take your time.
That's right. I'm sure the hours of post editing and auto tune goes into making me sound human.
I'll be auto tuning. All right. Yeah.
That's right. I've got a chemical engineering degree from the University of British Columbia, and it just happened to be because chemistry was musical to me. It was like that Breaking Bad character. It was like, wow, you know, just totally makes sense. It was effortless for some weird reason for me, And I thought, well, I can't really get a job with a chemistry degree unless I have a PhD. So is there anything similar to chemistry I can do? Well, chemical engineering sounds kind of similar, although it is actually very, very different. It's like a train engineer versus civil engineer, you know, same kind of a sort of name in there, but very different. I didn't want to be a cog in a big petrochemical wheel. Most of my classmates work in the sector.
Solidarity.
Yeah, that's right. So I spent about 15 years on fuel cells, hydrogen fuel cells, which are a type of energy technology similar to batteries. So we can get more into those later. I've also spent a couple years in the renewable energy consulting space, helping to do analysis for wind farms, some solar projects as well, to make them bankable, which is to say to have a third party group say, you know, we've done the analysis, we are confident that this project can, you know, generate this much cash flow based on these electricity prices, therefore it's safe to lend dollars to these people who want to build it. I also spent a couple of years working on EV infrastructure around British Columbia with a nonprofit, Plug-in BC. You know, props and shout out to those guys. And as a part of which, I did kind of an allegory, 150 presentations in 450 days, mostly in the Lower Mainland, sort of you know, Fraser Valley kind of area. I did about half a dozen to a dozen trips out to Victoria, which I probably entered many of your guys' neighborhoods, although not your buildings most likely, and tried to help multi-unit buildings, apartments, condos, townhouse complexes with shared garages, navigate the province's incentives for putting in EV infrastructure, because the likelihood that someone's going to buy an electric car is very low unless they're confident they can charge, preferably at home. So at the moment, I've spent the past year alternating between fuel cell and electric vehicle infrastructure work. And so that's kind of where I am in a nutshell. I guess my chemical engineering background gives me a bit more insight into the sort of fossil sector, how it operates, the thinking behind it, the sort of mental framework. But fortunately, I was able to diversify from the start of my career, which in retrospect was probably the best possible thing I could have done.
Thanks very much for the succinct kind of background, Matthew. This is Anthony speaking, by the way. There was just kind of one particular thing that I guess we're going to really get into the nitty gritty of that you mentioned there, which is the difference between batteries and fuel cell technology. And, you know, I consider myself decently techy, but I don't really understand the gist of the difference between those things. So could you please just kind of unpack for our listeners the difference in the practical application of each?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So batteries and fuel cells are cousins. They're both electrochemical devices. They don't use combustion. They use electrochemical reactions to liberate electricity, if you will. And a fuel cell is kind of like a battery, but with an external fuel tank or with an external reactant tank. In a battery, you've got like your cylinder that has all the reactants inside. You connect it through an electric circuit, and then you can move the electrons from one energy state to another one, releasing energy. Fuel cells, there are a variety of types, but the dominant type is called a proton exchange membrane fuel cell. That's the type I'd worked on. And those take hydrogen, for the moment, generally sourced from natural gas, but hydrogen, and they react it with the oxygen and air in an electrochemical manner, so no combustion. And so they generate electricity and water vapor. And the way to think of the trade-off between the two technologies is maybe to use an analogy from the animal kingdom. If you think of the smallest animals up to the size of like a large crab, the dominant type of skeleton you have is an exoskeleton. Because if you're an ant or a beetle or, again, you know, some crustaceans, it's hard to beat an exoskeleton for the strength-to-weight ratio. But the bigger you get in the animal kingdom, the more evolution, you know, Darwinian selection has favored endoskeletons, internal skeletons like vertebrates. And so that's why you have, you know, hummingbirds are probably the smallest vertebrates, but then you can go all the way from, you know, them to cats to horses, hippos, whales. And so the analogy would be that batteries tend to be the the best solution or the most efficient, effective zero-emission transport solution for smaller vehicles, thinking of things from e-bikes or, you know, other scooter-type things, skateboards, all the way up to cars and some trucks, some buses, with fuel cells having the ability to go down into these smaller sectors, cars, trucking, and then basically being the dominant form of a zero-emission transportation once you get into the long-haul trucking, trains, boats, planes. That's kind of the way, the most effective way to see where they fit in the ecosystem, in the zero transport space. Batteries are exoskeletons. At a certain point, the fuel cells just become more favorable in terms of basically weight and mass limitations.
Well, that's one thing I find really interesting, because a lot of the environmentalist movement is focused on like individual choices that you can make as a consumer. Mm-hmm. So I can buy an electric vehicle or I can ride my bike instead. But there's these parts of the economy that don't really get covered by that mindset, where we have things like shipping and aviation and, mm-hmm. You know, long haul trucking and stuff that's still very carbon intensive, but extremely difficult to just replace with like an, you know, electric counterpart. So, and this is like, there's almost no discussion on the, like in the environmentalist movement of how to, because usually the environmentalists will just say, well, we should just not fly, or we should just shop local instead. And the question just entirely ignored. So in what ways do you think, like, what are the challenges of decarbonizing those parts of the economy, and what ways can we actually make that carbon neutral instead of just abandoning them?
Yeah, so I don't think it's, I guess, having worked in the clean tech sector, I've learned the skill of patience, or sort of tolerating or managing my impatience. Let's put it that way. So at the moment, there's terrific enthusiasm and excitement about electric vehicles, and that's fantastic. I don't want to take anything from that. There is already systematic thought being put into these larger segments. So I'm not worried that there isn't as much conversation. Hey, you know, let's move the personal vehicle fleet as much to batteries as fast as we can. But there is ongoing work by people, very serious people. And so I think there's this phenomenon with EVs where it's which is butts in seats. Basically, if you have demonstrations, if you can see electric cars going around, then suddenly it becomes normalized. And people are like, yeah, why don't we do this kind of a thing? And so I'm confident, I expect that as the first fuel cell trucks, certain buses get more common outside of China, then there'll be a recognition and a mass movement towards those technologies. One thing I will comment, which is unique really about the personal automobile space, we've managed with difficulty to stay a one-car family ourselves, is that unlike almost every other form of transport, personal vehicles are consumer goods. So you will pay a premium for a Tesla or a Mercedes, or you know, maybe you buy a Toyota because you hear they're reliable, even if it's more expensive overall than like a $9,995 Nissan Micra, right? Which technically seats five very small adults. So almost every other form of transportation is commodity. Basically, if you can make a widget that is marginally cheaper, you can, you know, completely dominate the market. You can destroy the competition. And so the case with buses, public transportation buses, for example, would be one example, or delivery trucks, postal trucks, that sort of a thing. You could get 0% of the new orders being zero emission technologies, and you can go from 0% to like 100% in a very short time, in a matter of several years, say. It will take many years to turn over the fleet, because you try and make these vehicles work as long as possible, squeeze out as much value before spending more money. I guess what I'm saying is that the personal vehicles are more difficult because it's hard to convince people to decide to value something over another thing which might be in the short term cheaper. with commodity goods, as soon as you get this total cost of ownership lower, then everyone's self-interest kind of pulls them by the nose, and you can get them into the cleaner technology. The one sort of other way you can chisel your way in is virtue signaling companies, let's call them, who want to perceive that they're green, even if they're not necessarily. They might decide to pay a premium to purchase new units, even if they're somewhat more expensive, because they perceive it has more value. You know, if you're a Nike, well, probably not a good example, but if you're an Apple, for example, you want to purchase renewable electricity, even if it might be slightly more expensive than your utility, because you want your customers to think of you as a non-evil company.
I really like your explanation there, and I just kind of wanted to pick up on one thing. So you're talking about this distinction between commodity goods and consumer goods, and it's really interesting that in a, you know, at least nominally kind of government-controlled market, whether it's by the city or by the province, or depending on what level you're talking about, something like city buses, you can plan to kind of do this long-term rollout of the fleet. I can remember a recent Christmas dinner with my family, and we were talking about electric vehicles, decarbonization, and the problem of young folks, millennials, generally read people without access to gainful employment can't necessarily afford to buy new cars.
Exactly.
Why there's not more uptake with, you know, who would you'd also think are, you know, some of the most enthusiastic people to take on technologies like electric vehicles.
Right.
So is there a similar effect in the totally market sphere of just, you know, commodity vehicles, where we could anticipate kind of flooding the market with electrics? And then, given that, you know, barring the possibility of a total economic transformation of society, I'm probably still only going to be buying used cars 5 to 10 years from now. So is the idea just to kind of, like, you know, permeate the market with these vehicles? Can you see a similar trajectory there?
Yes. So, public policy can be a very powerful tool. BC does have a rebate program. It's actually a result of our low carbon fuel standard, actually, oddly enough, which is, I think, the big piece of legislation, incidentally, for this Trudeau government that I'm hoping that they can actually push through, because for various reasons, I think it's very catalytic towards moving guys to zero emission transport. But there is a rebate you can get through the Scrap It program, which gives you, I think it was up to $6,000, not for, for used, to trade in a used vehicle, used combustion vehicle, to get a used battery electric vehicle, you could get a rebate of up to $3,000. Now, that's not as generous as some of the programs that California has, where they provide additional purchasing support for people who are at 300% income of the poverty level and below, and basically addressing the exact point that you made. In the electric vehicle community, we have a dangerous blind spot in the idea that, well, I've bought an electric vehicle, I've done my part. Anyone who doesn't buy a $45,000 vehicle before incentives, well, you know, they're just being short-sighted or lazy, or I have solar panels on my house. And I have a personal garage for two vehicles, and that's just not the reality for many folks. And it has opened up the enthusiasts to brutal and not always unfair criticism from conservatives generally, who are like, these are incentives, you know, designed by rich policymakers for rich consumers, and, you know, the regular Joe suffers, even though, of course, these conservative commentators tend to represent even richer policymakers or interest groups. But you are correct. There are tools to make sure that more people are able to participate, and so it doesn't become a redistribution of advantages towards people who already had advantages to begin with.
In terms of fuel cells, if we go back to your analogy about small, you know, crustaceans and larger mammals, So can fuel cells be used to decarbonize aviation and shipping and long haul trucking? Is that a possibility?
That is, yes. So it's en route let me just take them in turn here. So in China, I'm actually, let me see if I can find the actual chart that I had. But from memory, I think it was there are about 2,000 fuel cell powered delivery trucks, like commercial, like, you know, those trucks that deliver stuff to like the 7-Eleven and whatnot.
Yeah.
There are about a couple thousand of those now, as well as a couple thousand buses. Maybe it was 4,000 trucks, 2,000 buses. At any rate, there are thousands of these in China at the moment, because when you have a country with that much scale, which is buying that much new equipment, you can deploy a lot fast. The vast majority of those are provided by fuel cells provided by Canadian companies. Yay. So in the trucking side, China is definitely a leader. There's a company also named after Nikola Tesla, this one called Nikola Motors, which has made a massive splash with a flamboyant CEO who's promising, you know, big stations and, you know, fantastic, sleek, futuristic trucks. And so they're actually suing Tesla for allegedly copying patents and design elements for their own battery powered truck. At any rate, so there is action going on primarily in China for now on the a larger trucking side. The Chinese efforts are geared towards city trucks that deliver around the city on a 24/7 basis. The Nikola is targeting long haul trucking. There are some trials in California as well, but those are very small numbers. On the shipping side, Norway, having had an astute industrial policy, and I know that we don't need to get into a Norwegian session about the public policy prudence that they've had over the decades, but they were the first to really start deploying battery electric ships or battery diesel hybrid ships for their oil sector, in fact, and they've now moved to developing fuel cell powered ships for longer run ferry routes and things of that sort. One of the cruel ironies is that a BC company called Corvus Energy, Corvus for Crow, Corvus Energy basically invented the battery energy pack system for ships. Like, they basically created the sector. And they now are controlled by a Norwegian consortium of a variety of Norwegian corporate titans. And the main reason is that Norway had all the deployment. So now, you know, the new head office is in Norway. They still have a manufacturing plant in British Columbia, but because there was like literally zero interest, zero public policy, you know, foresight in BC, it's now kind of a puppet of a Norwegian, a foresighted Norwegian company, which was foresighted on account of foresighted public policy. So that's on the shipping side. A lot of exciting stuff there. On aviation, there are a couple aviation startups which are looking at commercializing fuel cell airplanes that they have flown. They are in the process of getting, you know, what is FAA, you know, certifications and so forth. You can get up to 500 miles of range, 800 kilometers of range rather, with hydrogen gas compressed at about 500 bar. Sorry, that's probably too nerd speak for you guys. At a lower pressure than you would put in a hydrogen fuel cell car tank, a little bit higher than what you might have for a hydrogen fuel cell truck tank. So basically, and for the trains, it's also not at all a problem. There are initial deployments. The first massive wave of fuel cell vehicles is likely to come out of China. Just the battery electric buses came out of China starting 11 years ago. So it will follow the same trend, and there's kind of growth coming to the sector. At the risk of blathering on even more, I will quickly note that if you – I can send this chart later. If you put together a chart of the wind energy deployment in megawatts of capacity per year from the mid-90s, and if you overlay on that the solar sector growth, solar photovoltaic, solar panel growth in megawatts produced per year from about the early 2000s, and fuel cell production for the past half decade in megawatts of production. They all basically line up just with a date offset, and they're all growing at like 40% of annual production growth per year. So it's hopeful that we can continue this growth, because as you manufacture more of things, you figure out ways just through regular human problem solving how to make them cheaper, and you can basically start eroding the massive advantage fossil fuels have, because they're kind of like a magical energy liquids that that can be combusted with like 110-year-old technology, which has admittedly been refined, but it's hard to beat liquid fuels really for energy density.
So you mentioned fossil fuels. What do you think the collapse in the price of fossil fuels is going to do to all this? I mean, is it going to matter, or is it going to sort of reverse some of this, make some of these industries unprofitable, or what?
So yeah, that's a very good point. Now, there are a lot of elements to that. I would expect that the low price of fossil fuels in a weird way could hurt conventional hybrids, not sure it will, conventional hybrids more than fully electric vehicles. One of the reasons being that people who want, you know, who are determined that, you know, we want to do something less malign for the environment are going to choose electric vehicles as opposed to hybrids, for example. Hybrids are easy to justify when you're expecting high gasoline prices, and it does not look like we're going to be having high oil prices anytime soon. Many countries now, in the case of the U.S., it's mainly led by California, but China, Europe, BC, and Quebec now have regulations that pretty much require the sale of rising percentages of zero-emission vehicles on the part of automakers. And so this is a regulation which basically requires you to sell more of these vehicles as a percentage of total sales each year. And so relatively independent of the oil price, of the gasoline price or petrol price, if you're in Europe, those sales will tend to increase. Lobbying could result in those being relaxed, but that is a nice set of legislation that is in place that will ensure that this, you know, this promising wave doesn't kind of sputter out all of a sudden. The collapse in oil prices is also expected to cause natural gas prices to be very cheap for a very long time. That's kind of the miracle/debacle of the fracking revolution. And there we would expect, or we could expect, that that could slow down the growth of renewables in the electricity sector. That's not necessarily because they'll slow down the growth of renewables, which are, I guess, one thing to remember is that, you know, we're here in the developed world, but there's like, I don't know, seven times as many people of us in the majority world. And given the choice of if they can afford to get more natural gas power sooner, they will probably choose to get more natural gas-based electricity sooner and supplement it with all the solar and wind at the as soon as they can get those as well. So I guess the bigger danger would be on the electricity side, that we don't decarbonize as fast, but that's because more people are able to get access to firm electricity.
Well, this leads right into our next question, and I think Matt is a social democrat. I think you will.
Yes.
I think you'll understand this. There's a global power dichotomy going on, right? Like the global South has been completely ravaged out. You mentioned the 7 billion of us all together. For me, my hope was Bernie's plan, his international plan. A lot of people spoke consistently about Bernie not having, you know, what can he do when he's in office? Well, he has, no matter what, lots of power over foreign affairs, and he was planning to redistribute a lot of the military budget towards what the U.S. has kind of ravaged and taken out of countries in the global South. So do you see a way that we can kind of overcome this beyond the material conditions of what a gas price is?
F in the chat for Bernie.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. So There is like a 10-year-old perception, I guess it's probably about 10-year-old, that the fossil fuel lobby is super powerful, and maybe it is in certain areas. I'm pretty sure that with the oil prices where they are now, companies aren't going to, and company lobbying groups just aren't going to have the money to hire quite as many lobbyists. Now, you can still get a lot of support because you don't want workers to pay for unbelievably dumb mistakes by their CEOs. But I think that it is less a case of this bullying lobbying being able to sabotage things now. And we're in a more of a situation where we can proactively push into, as opposed to embattled, defend, you know, being besieged from backpedal, or being required to backpedal, or fighting on the back foot. Is that what it's called? So I do think there is. I was so hopeful for Bernie. It would have been nice to have a presidential candidate who hadn't been credibly accused of sexual assault.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
That for once.
Like, remarkable. Yeah, that's right.
God.
I do kind of hope that Jesse Ventura comes in because, as far as I know...
Well, please no. Please no.
Finally, a candidate I can respect.
That's right.
I just dusted off my article on the appointment of Vince McMahon to help restart the American economy. Let's not go back the idiocracy route.
That's right. Well, actually, hey, Linda McMahon.
Vince McMahon's the owner, right? That's this, you know, Jesse Ventura was
a worker.
He's on the other side. He's the guy, you know, doing the hard work.
That's right. And he was a mayor and a governor. And he actually came to power through the first viral media campaign in the late 90s. It was a remarkable achievement. At any rate, I had many hopes for the Bernie plan. It looks like the puppeteers who are guiding Joe Biden's policies do have a strong interest in climate. Nothing about reforming capitalism, mind you, or, you know.
I would protest that they don't really care about the climate. They care that people care about the climate.
That I would agree perfectly. Actually, not to get too far on a segue, but I've seen a lot of very vocal condemnations of Planet of the Humans. And without arguing its merits and demerits, I would generally say that it's like it's almost like a class or it's kind of a class manifesto.
That conflict between degrowth and I guess not degrowth in whatever way seems to have been something that's been percolating for quite a while now and still hasn't really come to a head. I don't know, maybe this movie is actually going to help that along.
I think it will, yeah. Like, well, it's going to force a very awkward conversation. And I think it's worth having that conversation so that people in the climate movement or the Green Party recognize that, okay, well, we have some fundamental differences. Hopefully, we can still temporarily ally ourselves so that we can actually get things done and then worry about fighting each other later. Because you don't want to have a situation like we have in Canadian politics where the Marxist-Leninists and the communists both run campaigns in the federal elections and split that vote. It's just a remarkable narcissism of small differences. Well, from the outside, it looks like a remarkable narcissism of small differences.
It'd be better if they could run in like real parties too, but they're just not allowed.
Yeah.
I actually had a question about that term that you just used, the narcissism of small differences, and how it plays into the energy factionalism that we see, you know, in the renewable sector, but, you know, also in the different kinds of ostensibly leftist political groups out there. Can you explain the term?
Yeah, so I think it was Freud who came up with this phrase, the narcissism of small differences, which is that, to paraphrase, and we can check how inaccurate I am on Wikipedia later. Basically, if you have two groups or two people who are very similar to each other, then they become intolerant to small differences in like, well, how dare they not have the same thought that I have on issue X, Y, Z? Or, you know, how dare Yeah, how dare the Communist Party run a candidate when, you know, we Marxist-Leninists are doing so. So I think
this fall in Victoria, it was how dare the NDP accuse Elizabeth May of actually saying that she would, I don't even remember, abortion issue.
That's right,
the abortion
right,
issue was crazy here in Victoria, and it was small differences.
That was right. Heated, yeah.
It was so
that
heated.
Now, I would think that there are actually, like, to me, and this is my personal view, is like the Green Party seems to be, at least from the folks I know, tend to be dominated by green growth, like liberals who just happen to have a lot more interest in the climate. It seems to be more of a middle classish kind of a party, whereas NDP definitely has working class roots. So I'm not saying it's necessarily untrue, because I'm not as familiar with how the NDP Green split is in Victoria, but certainly from a conservative perspective, they'd be like, what the hell are those, you know, yahoos talking, you know, arguing about? Aren't they the same thing?
You hit the nail on the head, Matthew.
I'm sure crocodiles and alligators argue with each other over who's better all the time.
The real question is, why don't the liberals and conservatives merge together? Their differences are so indistinct.
The game's over. Then people know they're the same.
I think the nutty thing for me is, who the hell is giving Peter McKay you know, social media tips? Like a rotary phone for a meme? Are you kidding? It seems like the conservative part, that the Stephen Harper reform wing, has been able to pull the progressive conservative party so far to the right that it leaves the entire gap of non-social conservative, you know, non-left wing, non-social conservative Canadians ripe for the liberals, which is just baffling to me. But of course, I might be simplifying the massive differences between the conservative faction within their own party.
They all kind of blended together a while ago.
It worked for Stephen Harper for quite a while. I mean, he didn't actually have to worry about this. But anyway, so back onto the topic. Whatever it was we were talking about earlier.
Narcissism and small differences.
Yeah. So within the environmentalist movement, I suppose, these differences are there. Now, I guess the thing I'm always a bit sort of I go back and forth on myself is the question of, like, how much do those differences matter? Because on the one hand, degrowth does seem to me kind of not good. You could argue it's like, well, there's not a huge difference between green growth and degrowth. But I'm like, well, it kind of looks like there is a big difference there.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think, and again, I think this is largely a matter of class. So I think that degrowth, the degrowth leaning people that I know are very, very uncomfortable with the idea of climate billionaires, you know, people who are, forget Elon Musk because he's kind of crazy, but there are people who are making massive fortunes by being the founders of solar panel manufacturing companies or, you know, wind turbines, things like that. And that's just not the ethic and the lifestyle they think should be appropriate. You have to be, you know, shrink your footprint, that kind of a thing. Maybe one possibly good example might be the U.S. has this thing called the production tax credit for wind. So it got extended recently. It's sort of tailing out over a number of years. But basically, someone builds a wind farm, they can get a credit for at one point it was like a couple cents per kilowatt hour of electricity that was produced. They could use that against their taxes. And that's a very leveraged advantage, because if you make obscene amounts of money, then you pay a large amounts of taxes. And then if you happen to buy a wind farm, then, or solar had a very similar kind of a thing, then you can shield yourself from paying taxes. So the open joke in the wind industry was that the main beneficiary of this production wind tax credit was JP Morgan Chase, the big, the big bank. And what they would do is they would arrange financing for all sorts of these wind farms, and their fee basically would be these tax credits, which they could then apply against their taxes. In a similar way, one of the reasons that Google, Apple, Microsoft, all these fabulously profitable software companies are announcing that they've, you know, built wind farms and so on and so forth, is it is amazingly lucrative for them because it greatly shields their taxes. The equivalent, I guess, basically because they're knocking off their taxes owing, if they knock off like, I don't know, $20 of taxes owing, that's the equivalent of actually having $100 extra revenue or add, you know, the postscript millions. So the degrowth side, or a lot of even people in the wind industry were like, well, we really don't need these tax credits. We're competitive. This is just making Wall Street and certain corporate titans even richer and, you know, advantaging them versus us who actually have to pay taxes. Whereas the green growth side, a lot of people will be like, well, you know, I'm not as happy about it, but I'm totally in favor as long as it keeps building wind more out more. So I think there's a fundamental tension between green degrowth and green growth. I am very sympathetic to many of the degrowth ideals, but I can't see how apart from wanting to redistribute profits and benefits in a more equitable manner, I can't see green growth not winning ultimately, which I'm sure is going to drive degrowth guys nuts, and which is why I think this movie, Michael Moore produced movie rather, is so stoutly defended in some quarters.
Thank you. So this is something dear to my heart. We've been talking about LNG for a really long time, and it's totally overproduced. And it just looks like it's on a total downward path. It looks like it's just no hope. And the tragedy is, you know, Kenny's tied Alberta directly to it. And so kind of, do you see a way that we can kind of move forward, helping the Albertan economy? Because I think one thing that you've kind of touched on is the small differences is that a lot of Albertans look at British Columbia saying like, LNG is kind of our lifeline a little bit here, right. And you're stopping it, and we're right. Saying you're stopping the planet. So it's a bit of a small difference.
Right. So the LNG projects that Christy Clark dreamed of back in 2012, 2013 were those were all from BC sources. Just to touch on the Alberta thing quickly, Alberta, like there will always be a role for energy exporters. The best thing to do for Alberta, apart from cleaning up all those gazillions of abandoned, orphaned, leaking wells, would be to start producing either petrochemicals. There will be an increase in the number of petrochemicals, precursors to plastics that people in the majority world will consume more of. But more broadly in producing zero emission fuels, that's basically going to be hydrogen, where either you push the CO2 back in the ground or you use Alberta's renewable resources to generate it. The blue hydrogen, these ridiculous color coding things, basically hydrogen, which you produce and then pump the CO2 back in the ground, is a likely near-term path because Alberta is going to need all the renewables it can get to decarbonize its own electricity. Turning to BC's LNG, that's a little bit of a different thing. So coal has already peaked, coal usage. Oil production absolutely peaked last year because there's no way this year is going to be higher than last year with the virus. And it would be very difficult to foresee a situation where you can actually climb past 2019 consumption. Even in 2021, 2022, not everyone's suddenly going to be, you know, jetting everywhere or doing as much with heavier fuels as we gradually erode transportation fuel use with electric solutions. So natural gas is actually the only fuel which is likely to see sustained growth. A very optimistic about renewables consultancy, DNVGL, I can send you guys the link offline. In their recent Energy Outlook report, this is for 2019, they expect global natural gas usage to peak in about 2033. And that's not at all driven by folks like us who are displacing fossil fuel from our grids. That is people in the majority world getting more fuel and cheaper now fuel to be able to actually enjoy more electricity and more conveniences. So LNG, the price has absolutely collapsed. But there is going to be a massive global demand, or even a rising demand, for the next decade, irrespective of this virus. No one's going to, I guess what I'd say is no one's going to get rich off of this, but there will be jobs. What I'm hopeful about, what I wrote about for the National Observer is, if we can build this so all the infrastructure is compatible with zero emission fuels, there will be a market forever and a day for zero emission fuels to be transported across oceans. We've been doing this kind of stuff for thousands of years as humans. We will continue to be doing that stuff. And so hopefully, instead of having this stranded asset kind of a thing, we can approach infrastructure to be compatible with zero emission solutions so that we don't actually have to build a new pipeline or something when the time comes that, when the wonderful day comes actually, that we have zero emission transport fuels being exported instead of fossil ones.
I personally am a really big fan of when the lefty solution is the fiscal solution as well.
The fiscal solution, sorry?
We can be fiscally responsible by producing hydrogen now and selling it later.
Okay, yes. Well, yeah, it's like the negative prices on the oil deliveries. That was remarkable. Some guys I followed said that the futures exchanges actually had to get software engineers to recode their platforms to allow for negative prices, which was kind of hilarious.
Sort of like a oil industry Y2K.
Exactly.
Okay, there's something that you mentioned there that I'd like to kind of unpack, Matt, which really gets at one of the ways in which I think that a class analysis in the situation can help mitigate some of the narcissism of small differences. I'm thinking about in the energy politics, as Ethan brought up, between BC and Alberta. And you mentioned a kind of a potential wellspring or renewable energy sector that could take root in Alberta, and that it could really be at the forefront of the new renewable economy. And you know, you mentioned this in one of your articles that we'll post the links to in the show notes here, as a boxing versus Aikido strategy, which I love the sound of, because it sounds to me exactly like, you know, how Marx would explain outgrowing the capitalist mode of production. It's not to, you know, destroy everything that stands and build from the ground up. It's to use that momentum of capitalist progress under the decrepit system when it can no longer contain its own productive growth, and slingshot forward into something new. So can you unpack where that potential is and how you see the nuts and bolts of that going?
Sure. So, it's been about 25 years since I read the Communist Manifesto. I haven't actually read Capital. But anyway,
you haven't been going to your Marxist-Leninist reading group. I'm so sorry to hear.
I assure you, one of my colleagues at work can educate me in fine detail on all the nuances. He engaged me in the conversation about certain practices in the country of Pooh recently. Anyway, of Winnie the Pooh, of course. So,
I was wondering about
the
that.
Aikido analogy. The Aikido analogy is basically, so in the end, Alberta will, Canada, everyone will benefit if we can export energy. We have like the world's second largest landmass and, I don't know, 50th largest population, some crazy thing like that. There is a lot of energy that we can access and have the ability to export. We have ports on, well, three coasts soon. We have three open to ocean ports soon, sadly. But the Aikido analogy is that, yes, there is a need to build energy infrastructure. The boxing situation would be to try to completely prevent it. And the difficulty with that is that once we have these zero emission technologies fully commercialized, if you have nothing, then basically Australia is going to take the majority of the export market share to Asia, because they have, like, they are also empty of people. They have massive deserts they can take advantage of, and they're also systematically extending their LNG industry, which has been going on for 30 odd years. They are systematically preparing to switch that over to a hydrogen, a renewable hydrogen export industry. So they're in discussion with a variety of Japanese companies to basically make these first exports. The first actual export of a small shipment of liquid hydrogen, like liquid natural gas, but chilled even cooler, was actually supposed to be in time for the Tokyo Olympics, which have now been postponed for a year. So they have even more time to do a big panache announcement there. So the Aikido analogy would be that, okay, there's this momentum, there's this need to get energy infrastructure. We all need all kinds of infrastructure. Then the effective way to take that momentum and turn it to everyone's mutual advantage would be to direct it in a manner that is compatible with the zero emission future, so that the moment you can get contracts signed for these zero emission fuels, you can start engaging in discussions about how to switch which fuel is being transported in the pipelines and at the various shipping and other infrastructure.
While we're just starting to wrap up, two more questions. One of them was forwarded by our mutual friend Lee Phillips. Since he wasn't able to join us, I asked him what he would like to ask you, and this was his response. So he said the license period for, since we're talking about LNG, the license period for the LNG Canada and Coastal GasLink period is, I understand, in the order of 40 years. LNG can play a role as a bridge fuel replacing coal in Asia and replacing bunker fuel in freighters until we can develop synthetic LNG at scale. But the period of that bridging is 10 to 15 years, not 40. Shouldn't the province be developing an industrial policy to develop a synthetic LNG industry, perhaps in the same central North Coast region, so that it's ready to go in a decade's time rather than, in effect, promising these communities fossil LNG jobs for four decades?
Right, yes. So that's a valid point. The concern being that, this actually builds on what I was just saying, in that we have to be putting the policy levers, the policy tools in place so that we don't get this stranded capital situation. In terms of synthetic LNG, it is possible to make biomethane from renewable sources. It is more complicated and expensive. It basically adds a process step, which adds costs relative to just generating zero emission hydrogen. So that's not the likely path for future energy exports. However, there will, unfortunately for the environment perhaps, still be an enormous market for LNG, for natural gas exports, in 40 years per the $7 billion, eventually $8 billion, eventually $9 billion, other folks in the majority world who want, higher, better standards of living, completely understandably. So I guess one thing I will want to comment on is that it is very unlikely that we're going to get any additional LNG projects going through, again, because the price is so low. There was this golden period which filled Christy Clark with these visions of pots of gold at the end of these rainbows. And that was because LNG suddenly became very expensive. And that was because a massive tsunami knocked out a nuclear reactor in Japan and caused Japan to suddenly shut off every nuclear reactor it had and thus immediately start importing and buying up all the LNG it could possibly get a hold of. So these visions of BC becoming a petrostate, which horrified me at the time, they were created by a specific situation where Japan had immediately gone from importing a bunch of LNG to importing insane amounts. As soon as they started to put their reactors back on, the LNG price dropped. It will continue to be low. It is hard to imagine many companies who have not already committed to exports will want to go forward, just as a context for future emissions. There is already a large renewable electricity to hydrogen project that has been announced in BC. It was announced early this year. It's in Chetwynd, and it will take about a 200 megawatt wind farm. It'll be the second largest in Western Canada, and it will use that electricity to generate hydrogen in these electrolyzers. It's like a reverse fuel cell. And that will then be injected into the natural gas grid for Fortis BC. Fortis, by the Clean BC plan, has to provide renewable gas energy from renewable gas by 2030 for a certain amount. The excess heat that is being used, that is being generated when this hydrogen is created, is going to be fed to a series of greenhouses operated by nearby First Nations, allowing for more food security and resiliency. So it's kind of a win-win all around. I think Lee is exactly right that we need to be developing this industrial policy. I'm a firm believer in that. I guess my only quibble is that instead of saying synthetic LNG, maybe I'd say, you know, zero emission fuels.
Okay. I guess just to close us out here, I have one final question for you.
Sure.
Given that we are a socialist podcast, do you think that we can realistically transition off of fossil fuels in a free market economy, or will the market relentlessly stymie our attempts at building a carbon neutral economy?
So I think that with policy, we can get off fossil fuels. Maybe to use the boxing versus Aikido analogy again, the Aikido approach would be within the existing structures that we have, the existing capitalist or, you know, self-benefit, non-centrally planned. I'm not a fan of central planning. Although I will completely agree with Lee that every large corporation is centrally planned. I just don't like large corporations myself. So what I would say is that regulations and policy can bring us and are slowly bringing us to a fossil-free economy. That will happen. It will take a while. I think that is the path. It is a faster path than hoping to dynamite the system and then have a more, more forceful socialist approach. The end result can be the same, and my hope is that from the left there can be enough enough of a threat, maybe, or not enough of a political force on the left to drive the policy and the strategy towards sustainability, towards a more equitable redistribution. I guess as old as I am now and as old as some friends are, I'm not holding my breath for a reboot of the system. As much as
I'm trying.
So I do foresee, like in the next 5 years, say, a very big moment where the power of capital gets eroded in favor of the power of labor. Like right now, to me, feels very similar to women's suffrage right after World War I. World War I consumes all these men, draws them out of the economy, women become indispensable. Now, at the moment with this virus, the pandemic is continuing on. The burden, there's a lot of burden is being taken by quote-unquote essential workers who are at the very bottom of the economic ladder. And I am hopeful that necessity, that indispensability can be leveraged into a more equitable arrangement because it's hard to imagine how it could be more unfair, basically. There was a shift in the 30s towards more of a compassionate or a more equitable society with the Great Depression. In the 70s, you had this massive pushback from capital. Mark Blythe, Professor Brown University, talks about this. And then we're kind of overdue for another swing back in the direction of labor. So I'm hopeful there.
Okay. Did you guys have any other questions you wanted to ask?
I've got one closing question.
Sure.
Are you related to Glenn or Ken Klippenstein?
very distantly. So yes. So as near as we can figure out, his grandfather helped my grandfather immigrate to Canada after World War II. Now, whether they were cousins, or as my side of the story has it, that they actually immigrated the wrong guy, who happened to have the same name, is open to question, but we might have to do some Elizabeth Warren type of genetic tests to figure that one out.
I'm sure you'll put yourself out on a limb and
just
declare what you think happened publicly. Yes. And
don't be afraid to take some self-care time after if you don't want to talk about it.
I'll adopt a big dog.
Aww.
All right. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for being on the show. That was a great discussion.
Thank you so much for having me. Lots of fun.
Yeah, it was great.
Absolutely. Yeah, hats off to you. Thanks.
Yeah, well, we can only hope that we will transition to a carbon neutral economy sometime in the next century. Yeah, well, big ups to Pakistan. I read that they were putting their furloughed workers into planting trees in their spare time. So
that's a good approach. Yeah.
Okay. Did you have any closing thoughts?
No. Thanks for having me. You know, big props to the podcast. I actually first came across you guys when you had done a story on Musk, Elon Musk, for 2 years ago, I think it was.
Yeah, I remember.
And so then I've been avidly listening since. There's a remarkably motley and diverse community of people who track his moves and kind of tabulate where we think fraud is happening and so forth. So
we're all haunted by the specter of Musk.
That's right. That's right.
Specter exactly. Of the entrepreneur, the cult of neoliberalism.
The sort of a wannabe John Galt kind of a deal.
All right, Matthew. Well, thanks again.
I felt really good about that, boys. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I've overall felt really good about it, especially around the whole boxing versus Aikido analogy. I think that is really great. You know, brings out the accelerationist sympathies in me a tiny bit. but it's reasonable too, right? Or it gives you a concrete idea of what could be done. I kind of tailed off like a little, or didn't tail off so much as just diverged from being wholesale in agreement, where he said he was kind of opposed to central planning. And
yeah,
I
was like, you had some.
Yeah. Right? I mean, we could have
opinions.
I found it very surprising, and yeah. We probably could have waxed on about that for, you know, the length of a whole other episode, but I found
you
my
had, like,
mind
great
was racing.
Green party.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so I just kind of found myself wondering, like, wow, is the idea or is the expectation here that the shock to the system, the kind of virtual restart, for the titans in the energy sector delivered by the COVID-19 pandemic, is that somehow making that solution more viable? Yeah. Or you know, I mean, like the kind of classic neoliberal, like, work by increasing government regulation in order to, you know, have a market sector where none of the actors can monopolize or oligopolize and they all remain at a sustainable scale. Like, is the idea that is somehow now feasible again? Or is it just kind of still perennially misguided? I don't know. I don't really see exactly where it syncs up with
maybe just,
the current historical moment.
I agree with you, though. Like, it needs, I think this crisis more than anything is like, yeah, it needs to be centrally planned, because like we can't have people like throwing out potatoes. Like, that's dumb as shit.
Well, yeah, I mean, and you're seeing that all over the world. I mean, the only governments that have been able to respond competently are the ones that have kind of taken more direct control. I mean, you even see that in British Columbia, right?